to the KTEP Book Club on Perspectives. I'm your host, Louis Sines. And joining us today is Greg Iles. Greg is the New York Times bestselling author, and his latest book is called Natchez Burning. Actually, Natchez Burning is the book that it just came out in soft cover, but it was in hardback for a while, and there's an interesting story behind Natchez Burning, and we'll talk a little bit about that in just a minute. But first of all, Greg, thank you very much for being with us here today.
I'm glad to be here.
And Greg was born in Germany in 1960. He grew up in Natchez, Mississippi, and graduated from the University of Mississippi in 1983. He was active in a band called Frankly Scarlet, but quit after realizing that the touring lifestyle was not conducive with his family life. Once no longer busy with the band, he turned his attention to writing. And Greg's novels have been translated into various languages and are published in more than 20 countries. In addition to his popular novels, he wrote the original script for the movie 24 Hours, later named Trapped. When not writing, Greg spends some of his time playing music. He's a member of the Rock Bottom Remainders, and that's an interesting band that we're going to talk about in just a minute. But again, we're visiting with Greg Iles. He is the author of the book Natchez Burning. And Greg, as I mentioned, thank you very much for being with us here today. And I talked a little bit about your history. And tell us a little bit about, first of all, as I mentioned, you were in a band called Frankly Scarlet. And so I guess some music was your first love. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was. You know, I end up talking about this a lot because I talk to kids a good bit. Music was the thing. You know, there's nothing better or more enjoyable than playing music because it's like a instantaneous opiate feedback loop, you know. If you've ever been in front of 1,000 or 10,000 people playing acoustic music and singing harmony and you can hear a pin drop, there is nothing on the planet better than that. And compared to that, writing novels is sitting in a room by yourself for 2 or 3 years with no feedback whatever. You know, I'd choose the former any time. It's just that I wasn't good enough to be the best in the world at the former. And as I say jokingly, I didn't want to get a real job. So I took on writing. And needless to say, I found out writing is more work than a lot of real jobs.
But as I mentioned earlier, also, you still are in a band, so you still can do a little bit of that, and that's the Rock Bottom Remainders. But there's an interesting concept behind this band, especially some of the members. If you wouldn't care to talk about them?
Oh, yeah. Well, the Remainders, I was not the original member. I saw one of the second show they ever did. I've been in it for over 15 years. Probably close to 20, actually, but the band's existed for 25. And it was founded by a media escort in San Francisco who got to know that a lot of writers like Stephen King and Ridley Pearson, Amy Tan, Dave Barry, later Mitch Albom, Matt Groening of The Simpsons, and now Roger McGuinn of The Birds plays with us. But she found out that a lot of these writers had played a musical instrument. Some had been professionals, but others just did it as a gag or did it as a hobby. And she put them together at Anaheim for what you used to call ABA, the American Booksellers Convention. And when they finally walked off stage, Stephen King looked around and said, "We're not done yet." And from that, it grew into really a pretty massive phenomenon where all the gigs were for charity, generally for children's literacy. The members have changed somewhat over the years, but the core for quite some time now has remained the same, which is myself, Dave Barry, Steve, Mitch, Alan, Amy. God, it's hard to... Scott Turow is one of our female background singers. I say that in all seriousness. And, of course, Roger McGuinn, which has been... That's been some of my best moments. I mean, a few years ago, I found myself on the same mic with Roger in front of 20,000 people at UCLA singing and playing 8 Miles High and Turn, Turn, Turn. And I thought, you know, just shoot me now, man. This is cool enough, right?
That's incredible. Now, is this music available on a CD or on YouTube that people can purchase? I would imagine that perhaps if you haven't done it yet, this would be a good idea to raise funds.
It's years ago, right before I was in it, they sort of put together a thing with a studio band and members singing. But mostly you just have to see YouTube. But ironically, I got an email yesterday from Dave Barry and Ridley Pearson, and somebody apparently does want to put us in the studio and get down some of our originals and funny stuff. And so I got a feeling in the next 2 or 3 months we will be going in the studio to do that.
Now, you mentioned that you, and of course you're being very humble, saying that you weren't good enough to follow that life. And I know that having been in a band myself and also in, as a TV journalist, it's not a family life and you have to do something else. But at what point did you decide that you wanted to write? Have you always written since you were younger?
In all honesty, Louis, writing was just something that it was just something I could always do. You know, I once did a panel with Scott Turow and Amy Tan out at, I think we were at Stanford, about whether writers are born or made, or in other words, can you teach people to write? And while I think you can help people to become better writers, I think most writers that I know who are really successful were just born to do it. In the same way that, like, if I tell you I can sing, how many seconds does it take you listening to me sing to know whether I can sing or not? 5 seconds?
It's a few seconds.
Okay. The same is true with writing. Now, people don't believe that. They think because they can write a legal brief or a letter or a whatever, that they got A's in college on English, that they can write a novel. But it's a very different thing. And when people have to send something to an agent and it says, you know, just send a one-page letter and one chapter, people think, well, how could they possibly judge my vision by one chapter? And I want to say, look, you'll be lucky if they read past the first page, because in the same way as listening to a singer, I can read one page and I can tell if somebody, A, has command of the language, B, if they have a unique voice and a narrative tone that inspires confidence and makes me want to go on. So, you know, ironically, I didn't write my first novel until over 10 years after I left college, and I hadn't written anything since writing my college senior term paper. But I sat down and wrote a best-selling novel in a year, you know. And I think, I'm not bragging at all. I'm just saying I sort of resignedly and reluctantly turned to the thing I knew that I was able to do but didn't really want to do at the time.
And John Irving, another well-known writer, of course, he says the first sentence is the most important of the book because that's what grabs the reader.
That's exactly right. And ironically, I feel bad. I had to violate that rule in The Bone Tree because that's what comes out in 3 weeks, and it's book two of the trilogy. And I have a fantastic first line and first page of The Bone Tree. But because I felt it was incumbent on me, in case anybody bought that book not knowing it was book two of a trilogy, I felt they deserved some sort of recap of the first book. So I had to put in a prologue, and I'm glad I did it for those people, but that means that when people open it, they don't get the just visceral impact of that great, what was meant to be the great first sentence and verse, first page, you know?
Well, when I get the book, I'll just go straight to chapter one.
There you go.
Okay. First of all, Natchez Burning, is that the way you pronounce it, by the way?
Yeah, Natchez rhymes with Natchez, so
okay.
It's Natchez Burning.
Natchez Burning, that's the town that you grew up in. And so you know Mississippi. You went to the University of Mississippi. So you're very familiar with what you're working with, what you're writing about. And this is a huge book. I mean, it's about 800 pages long. And I would imagine that it makes some of Victor Hugo's book looks like little golden books.
If you're holding that paperback, you see it's pretty much as big as two bricks, I would say.
Yes, yes.
I would urge people to read it. But, you know, it's that big because the story's told in what a friend of mine and I call a very granular way. The irony is that whole book takes place in about 4 days, and it's 800 pages long. So you're seeing a very up-close view, but then again, you're also getting flashbacks to 1964 and 1968. So when you're dealing with a book that big and themes that complex, it's hard to characterize it in a few sentences. But I think the closest parallel for those in your audience who've read, for example, Lonesome Dove, you know?
Yes.
A really big book that you wish could have just gone on forever, you know? My rule is, you know, if a book is bad, it can't be short enough, and if it's good, it can't be long enough. And I think Natchez Burning hopefully falls in that category.
We're visiting with Greg Iles. Greg is New York Times bestselling author. His most recent book is Natchez Burning, and part two is coming out later. Also, part three, it's a trilogy. But before this, in 2009, I believe it's when you had The Devil's Punch Bowl. Is that correct? Is that, am I right?
That's right, Devil's Punch Bowl.
Okay, tell us a little bit about that book.
Well, The Devil's Punch Bowl, you know, it's a Penn Cage novel. I never set out for Penn Cage to be a series character. I like reading series because we all like, you know, going visiting familiar characters. But as a writer, I don't really like revisiting the same territory. I like to cover the most piercing moments in a character's life and then move on. But Penn Cage, every few years, he would come back. And so prior to Natchez Burning, there were three Penn novels. And The Devil's Punch Bowl was also set here in Natchez. And it had to do with casino gambling and, I hesitate to say it because so many people are horrified by this. It also had to do with dog fighting, of which there's quite a bit around here. And it sounds like, oh, it may be a trivial thing, but I assure you it's not. It's a pretty intense read on its own. Now, it doesn't, I would say it's not as intense as Natchez Burning because it doesn't get into quite the heavy themes that Natchez Burning does. But Devil's Punch Bowl basically was the first book of mine that went all the way to number one. All my books except one had been New York Times bestsellers, but Devil's Punch Bowl went all the way to the top, and that's really what put me in this sort of space I was in when I had my accident, where you sort of feel like, well, okay, I've gotten further in life than I ever really dreamed I would, and where do you go from here? And I had begun to take on Natchez Burning, and then that's when the accident happened. And so as a friend of mine always said, adversity's always waiting right around the corner. Don't ever doubt it.
And people may not be aware of what we're talking about or what happened, but you were in 2011. You had just about completed this novel, Natchez Burning, when you had that turn of events. You were in an accident, and not only did it change your perspective on life, but also, according to some people, it changed the way this book turned out.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to make this be one novel, and I was starting to realize there was no way one novel by any formula was going to hold this story. And that's a problem for publishers, and I had some friction with my publisher, and we weren't sure what to do. And I was on a very trivial mission in my car, and I pulled onto Highway 61, and a truck hit me right at my driver's door going 70, and you know, ripped my aorta, took my leg off, shattered my pelvis, broke 20-something bones. And a lot like my bandmate Stephen King, I mean, it came about as close to death as you could come. So when I came out of that coma, I just realized you don't have an infinite amount of time to write the great American novel or to say whatever it is you might really want to say. And so at that point, I stopped caring what the publisher thought, what agents thought, what readers, what anybody thought. And I said, you know, it's time to just tell the truth about this. If you're going to write about race in America, in the South, you got to be unafraid and let the chips fall. And so I really had no expectation that this book would sell. I certainly didn't think it would sell to Hollywood or anything like that. And ironically, when I became fearless and stopped caring at all about sales, suddenly the book breaks out and explodes and becomes this phenomenon. It's the weirdest thing that's ever happened to me.
Now, we're visiting with Greg Iles. Greg is New York Times bestselling author of Natchez Burning, and he has, of course, some other novels that have been on the New York Times bestselling list, and The Devil's Punch Bowl is the one that went to number one, as he just mentioned. And he was talking about the protagonist, Penn Cage. It's a lawyer-turned-novelist who first appeared in, I believe it was The Quiet Game, was it? Okay. And so we talk a little bit about that. He writes about that, and you mentioned that the accident and how it changed things, and you were dealing with when you came out of your coma, everything changed because I was dealing with the loss of the greatest mentor in my life, my father, and I was dealing with almost losing my life, and I realized that life was too short to pull any punches, so I decided there was no room in this book for formula and fluff, which is basically what you just said. And this is read from a review that was done, I believe it was from the Greenville News. And so you mentioned, you know, no pulling punches. Tell us, you grew up in Natchez, Mississippi, and so some of these things that you saw and you experienced is the Natchez Burning pretty much, what really exists, or, you know, obviously you're not exaggerating because this thing really did happen, but it's hard for some people to read. They'd rather just, turn their face or go to another chapter.
Well, yeah, it's a complex subject. I'll say I've exaggerated to some extent the present day, because in truth, the South has come very much further than anybody in the North believes on the subject of race in modern times. But the stuff from the past is very much based on actual cases, and the heroic reporter in the book, Henry Sexton, is based on a friend of mine, a guy at a tiny little newspaper in Faraday, Louisiana, the home of Jerry, the claim to fame is it was the home of Jerry Lee Lewis and Jimmy Swagger. Some terrible murders happened in that area and in the Natchez area, and Natchez Burning very closely parallels those murders and possible solutions. And I dig into the background of a group called the Silver Dollar Group, which was the most violent offshoot of the Ku Klux Klan in American history. Now, I never dealt with the Klan much, even when I was a thriller writer, because the Klan by 65 was thoroughly infiltrated by the FBI. They were pretty much ineffectual. You know, people in the North watch Hollywood films and think, you know, everybody runs around in a bedsheet down here. That's very unrealistic. But the Silver Dollar Group was very much like a terrorist cell, very secretive. The only ID they had was each man carried a silver dollar minted in the year of his birth. They were war veterans. They were very violent. And not one was even arrested until 40 years after the murders they committed. Now, having said all that, I want to say this. The real lesson of Natchez Burning in this trilogy is right around us in the news today, every single day. And that is, it was very easy in the 60s, if you lived in New York, to point at Mississippi and Alabama and Arkansas and say, oh, look how terrible racism is. But the fact is, racism was then and always has been universal, and it ran from California to New York and from Michigan to New Orleans. And I can tell you how. In 64, when Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman disappeared, the biggest manhunt in American history started for those civil rights workers. Two bodies washed up on the Mississippi River shore not far from Natchez during that hunt, and there was one crazed day of communication between the Jackson Field Office of the FBI and D.C. because they thought the civil rights workers had been found. Then it turned out to be just two black kids murdered. And guess what? The national spotlight instantly went back to Neshoba County, and those two black kids' murders were not solved for 40 years. Now, that's not because nobody in Mississippi cared about those two black kids. Nobody across the country much cared about those two black kids. They cared about the two white kids that disappeared in Neshoba County. And that right there is enough to tell you that racism and apathy about race murder is a national phenomenon, not a local one.
We're speaking with Greg Iles. Greg is a New York Times bestselling author. His latest book is Natchez Burning. Actually, it's out in paperback now. And it's part one of a trilogy that involves his main character, Penn Cage. And he's talking a little bit about racism in the South and some of the strife that's been going on. And as we mentioned, Greg, you were raised in Natchez. And the fact that you experienced some of this, did you have to do a lot of research for this book, or did you just go interview people who lived in that area? What did you do?
When I was 5 years old, the biggest Ku Klux Klan meeting in American history happened 1 mile from my house. My dad took me down there just to see it. My dad was very liberal, and he was a white doctor who treated mostly black patients. And what I remember, and it scares me to this day, was seeing the horses wearing white robes and hoods, and little kids in white robes and hoods, and women. And I mean, no, I didn't have to do much research on this because I live this. Now, it's ironic because Natchez is actually one of the most liberal places in Mississippi. It's it's a very wealthy place. In 1850, there were more millionaires here than anywhere in the country except Philadelphia and New York. It sided mostly with the Union during the war. Natchez surrendered during the war. That's why it's intact today. But in the after World War II, a lot of manufacturing came here, and with that came the working class white labor pool to fill those factories. And with that came the real rank and file of the Ku Klux Klan membership around here. Now, that's not to let off the affluent people. You know, in the affluent, among affluent racists, you had the White Citizens Council, and we certainly had some of that here. But For example, when I was in junior high, my best friend was a Jewish kid, and his uncle paid us to clean out the up top of their store, and we found a list of names, and on the names were the names of some of the kids we went to school with. And I found out, I went to a private school at that point, and we found out later it was those kids' fathers, and the Jewish community at that time maintained a list of people who were members of the Klan and the White Citizens Council. So, you know, this is all very personal to me, and it's the kind of thing where at some point you sit down and say, hey, we got to talk about how things really were. And I think that's why people have responded.
We're visiting with Greg Iles. Greg is a New York Times bestselling author. His recent book is Natchez Burning, and he's gotten some great reviews. Stephen King says, extraordinarily entertaining and fiendishly suspenseful. I defy you to start it and find a way to put it down. And Jody Picoult, every single page of Natchez Burning is a cliffhanger that will keep you devouring just one more chapter before you put it down. Now, those are some strong endorsements, my friend, both from, you know, Stephen King, who everybody knows, and Jody Picoult, who is just, you know, all her books just sell as soon as they come out.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and when you get things like that, I mean, one of the things that meant a lot to me was when the future of this thing was still completely in doubt, we didn't know what would happen or whether people would accept the trilogy, I happened to be on Twitter, and somebody told me to look at a certain thing, and there was a tweet by Ken Follett, you know, who wrote Eye of the Needle,
yeah,
and all those things, and Ken Follett tweeted, best thriller in years, Natchez Burning. Not best thriller this week or this month, but in years. And I thought, my God, you know, when I was a teenager, I was reading Ken Follett, you know, and here is this guy. And so when you get those kind of things unsolicited, you just you feel like, okay, maybe I'm going in the right direction. You know?
And as you mentioned, you know, this book is 700, almost 800 pages long. And, you know, people will look at it and they'll say, how can you read a book that long? But someone who loves to read and who really gets into this book, as the reviewers have described it, it can't be long enough. And they're waiting for part two. You know, come on, hurry up. And that's the way it goes. So my question is, how did you decide, because you featured Penn Cage in, I think, four novels?
Yeah.
And so how did you decide to involve Penn in the trilogy,
well,
to continue it?
I think my dad had passed away. I had been dabbling with how I was going to deal with these unsolved civil rights cases, and I think Penn just became the natural vehicle because of his relationship with his dad. I mean, if I had set out and written a novel about, let's say I just wrote a thriller about these unsolved civil rights murders, I don't care how good a job I would have done, it would have been too conventional, or it would have been didactic and people just would have turned away from it. You know, if you're gonna have people really read about race as an issue and violence in the 60s, there's only one way you're going to pull people through that, and that is to engage them with something they absolutely must know the answer to. And that always leads you to family and secrets and the things that we can all relate to. And so that's why Penn was the natural vehicle for that.
Now, this year, and it's not a coincidence, I don't think, but perhaps you didn't plan it this way. I'm sure you didn't because of your accident. But the fact that this novel has come out and then part two is coming out shortly. But this is also the year that people have been talking about To Kill a Mockingbird, because that second script manuscript was found. And then this is the anniversary of the end of the Civil War, the anniversary of Lincoln's assassination. So all this is tied into the South somehow. And the fact that people will read books about certain things like this, the, you know, mistreatment of black people, just like Atticus Finch was a hero. And people are willing to read about this and want to know about it. But at the same time, it's almost like, you know, a dark chapter in our history. And so they'd rather not talk about it, but they enjoy reading about it.
Yeah, it's one lady I was talking to said it. It's like family secrets, you know. Most
yes.
of the time we don't talk about them. It's like the crazy aunt we keep in the basement or whatever. But they're at certain times, particularly now, I think, with Ferguson going on and some of these other clashes, it makes people say, well, we have to sort of confront this and figure out the genesis of these problems. Why are they still with us? You know, when Barack Obama was elected, people really were talking about America being a post-racial society. And now, only this few years later, that sounds almost laughable when you look at the conflict that's going on, and it seems unsolvable. And clearly, a lot of insight is going to be required, and on the part of particularly the white community, but I think both communities, to try to solve these issues.
And of course, we're also seeing some of the negative feelings towards Jews because of what's happening in Israel. And people are kind of like, well, we have to decide, take one side, take it the other. So it's, again, kind of resurfacing all of this that we thought was behind us. But as you mentioned, it's the ant we keep in the basement. And once in a while, Auntie wants to come up, you know, and say hello to everyone.
These tribal things, these tribal instincts that we have that are the root of sectarian conflicts, whether it's religion or race or whatever, these things have, without sounding too corny, they've always been the bane of human evolution, human existence, and they will not be easily banished because they're so deeply tied to the instincts that let us survive. You know, I don't want to get too heavy, but that's sort of the problem. You know, when we can be rational, and particularly usually one-on-one, when people are one-on-one with people of other races or other religions, everything's fine. But when you start thinking in group terms, tribal terms, we get into real trouble. And nobody really has a solution for that.
We have been visiting with Greg Iles. Greg is the New York Times bestselling author of various novels, and the latest one is Natchez Burning, which features his character, Penn Cage. And this is the fourth novel that Penn is featured in. But Natchez Burning, there's a lot of history behind this book, because when he was almost finished with the book, Greg had a near life-threatening accident, which cost him a leg, a torn aorta, broken bones, and he was in a coma. And so the book is finished. It's 800 pages long, but get ready because book two and book three are coming. Now, Greg, is there a website that you would like people to go to find out more about your books and more about the history of perhaps about Penn or something else?
I'd just say just go to gregiles.com, and that's I-L-E-S. You can see, you can find out what you need to know about reading books in order or not. You can see clips of the Rock Bottom Remainders and just get a little taste of Natchez and this universe. And I don't know, I'm sort of past, it's weird, I'm past the point of saying, you know, promoting things and saying, go do this. You know, if you're interested, check it out. And I think, you know, the older I get, I find it's rarer and rarer I find things I really want to read and get lost in. But I really think Natchez Burning is one of those books for people, and I hope they find it.
Well, Greg, thank you very much for taking time to be with us here today. We've been visiting with Greg Iles. He is the New York Times bestselling author. The latest novel is Natchez Burning. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Norma Martinez. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.